in the fall of 1946, you started teaching Jacob Viner's price theory course. And at that time, you were just Milton Friedman. So it's pretty extraordinary position to be starting out in after 1 year of teaching at the University of Wisconsin. What were the primary published works that you had done that caused the University of Chicago to hire you? What do you think was the major work that you had done?
I think you have to go back to something else. I think you have to go back to the years of 32, 3, 4, when we were all students there, and the faculty of the University of Chicago got to know that among the student body there, among the graduate student body there, there's a sense in which, if I may say so, now, I would not have said so then, George Stigler, Alan Ross, and I stood out very much. I was a student in Viner's course. I took his course. And the faculty of the University of Chicago got to have an appreciation for those people before any published work came out. Now, you ask what publications. The most important publication, I guess, up to that time. Interestingly enough, I don't think anything was published in the field of price theory except in terms of income from independent professional practice. And I think that the book I wrote with Simon Cousins, which also served as my doctoral dissertation at Columbia, I think probably the best thing to do from that point of view would be to look at my chronological bibliography.
Sure.
And that's right here. No, okay. Okay.
Thank Gloria for this one. I had co-authored with Carl Schelf and Ruth Mack a book on it.
Yes.
That wasn't a very important book. It was, in terms of books, the only one was Income from Independent Professional Practice, which came out in 1945. But in terms of articles, let's go and let's see. I had an article in the Quarterly QJE in 1935 about the electron, about Professor Bagoo's method of measuring elasticities of demand. And incidentally, let me go back again. I spent the year 32 to 33 as a graduate student at Chicago, but 34 to 35 as a research assistant at Henry Schultz. And that probably provided more information to the faculty than did my publications, because Henry Schultz's book, Theory and Measurement of Demand, that he was working on, his masterpiece classic, I wrote considerable parts of it. And that was known around the department. The department understood. Schultz was a great man in a sense that I did not appreciate at the time, but didn't have since. In the sense that he was open to criticism from a very junior assistant and had no... So many people find it impossible to have somebody as an inferior who may be their superior in intellectual ability. Anyway, going on to your original question, if you look at here, there are... Twenty published pieces before 1945, and some of those were pure statistics.
Yes,
like an article on like the article on ranks, use of ranks. But there was article in QJE, article in the Journal of the Royal Statistical Society, Journal of the American Statistical Society. Reviews in the American Economic Review. There was a published, but more important than the published material was a personal knowledge of the people at Chicago. Through, you must remember that economics at that time, even more, much more than now, was a fairly closed, self-contained profession, which everybody knew everybody else, where they were. And they knew him not only by virtue of the printed record, but by virtue of personal contact. Remember, during that period, we were all in Washington. It was a New Deal period, and all of the academic admissions would come to Washington. Viner, for example, was very close to the Treasury and was a major advisor to Morgenstern. So that, as you know, that post would originally have been filled by George Stigler. He was the one that initially, and now take George. Ted Schultz had brought George Stigler to Iowa State when Schultz was chairman of the Department of Iowa State. Then when Schultz shifted to Chicago, became chairman of the Department of Chicago, it was natural for him. He knew all about George. He was aware of his quality. So somehow, I don't know. If you're going to talk about how things might have been, the world might have been very different if George hadn't spoken rather loosely and been misunderstood by Caldwell at that time. History would have been very different. This shows a role that chance plays.
Yeah. You have said a number of times that Viner was the one who gave you the sense of how the price system could allocate resources in a decentralized way, that he really made you see the power of the price system. And you may remember the last time I visited, I was fortunate enough to meet Aaron Director, and I asked him, when did you become a liberal? And he said, well, it was with the course I took from Jacob Viner. When you started teaching this course, did you have the sense that you were going to teach the course in the same way, that you had that same standard to measure up to? Were you aware of that?
There's no question that the course I taught was very largely Viner's course modified. I had my own notes from Viner's course. In fact, I still have them somewhere. I'm not sure where they are now. They're probably in the archive. But there's no question. First of all, I should say I had taught a course part-time at Columbia, and I had taught a course in Wisconsin when I was there for a year. I don't think I taught theory. I didn't think teach theory at Wisconsin.
It was a course in the business cycle. Right?
I taught a course in the business cycle and one in statistics, if I remember rightly. But when I came to teach the course on 301, the theory course, there's no question that I based it. It was an expansion of Viner's notes. Now, over the course of years, it developed. Of course, it changed from year to year and quarter to quarter, but it maintained the basic structure, which I think was involved in Viner's structure of teaching economics as a machinery for analysis.
And I want to recount my personal experience at Chicago and then relate that to your course. I didn't realize this at the time, but every course I took when I went there was basically good price theory. And I was always carrying around questions to think about, problems. And I don't know, choose your terminology, some other people would say brainwashed. But when I left Chicago, price theory was a way of thinking about the world. And the reason it was so was not because of the formal elegance of it. It was just something I had used so often through experience. Mm-hmm. I knew it was a practical, useful sort of tool. So I assume from the beginning that when you taught your course, you were challenging your students to think about, to apply their analysis in ways that would show them that, hey, I can use this to sort of figure out things about the world, and they would then see that, yeah, this was a useful tool, but it requires them to sort of apply the tools that you were teaching.
But I'm pretty sure that that was not a conscious decision. Mm-hmm. And I never sat down and said, that's what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
That it just came as a result of the... That was the way Viner taught it. Knight, when he taught 301, it was a very different kind of a course. It was Knight was Knight. But I think it was part of the atmosphere of Chicago when I was a student and also when I was on the faculty to take economics seriously. I think that at the time, if you think of what was going on at a place like Harvard, they were in a sense not taking economics seriously. Economics was a game, and that's what's happened now with all the models. Economics is not a serious way of understanding the world. Economics is a branch of abstract mathematics. And the models are valuable in and of their own right, even if they don't enable you to understand the real world. Certainly, real business cycle has that approach, has that cast to it. It's a game. It's an intellectual discourse. It's like doing pure mathematics. And that was never the case at Chicago. It always was. And that, I think, really traces back to Marshall. The engine of analysis phrase is a Marshall, comes from Marshall. It's in the principles.
But there's another aspect of it in this period when you think about ISLM. I mean, on the one hand, macroeconomics could spend 20 years in the desert in the sense of having models that were not grounded in price theory. They had nothing to do with price theory.
Well, those models didn't really start. You're now thinking of the Keynesian Revolution.
Right.
That started in 36, of course,
right.
Earlier in Cambridge, but in the world at large in 36.
The purpose, there were two things. One is that the models did not come out of price theory, and the second thing was they were chosen to tell policymakers what to do rather than being chosen to generate testable implications which could be falsified and then, you know, forced to reject the model.
So this is mostly the interpreter of Keynes rather than Keynes himself. Keynes really was a Marshallian in method. And I think you can take Keynes and pretty much treat it as a straight application of price theory to the aggregate economy. With the big difference that whereas in price theory you regard the quantities is given and the prices is variable. He regarded prices as given and quantities as variable.
that was the intellectual environment of the Depression, where people thought the price system did not work.
Absolutely.
But your point is he retained the Marshallian
framework. He analyzed it entirely within the Marshallian framework.
Yeah.
It was really when Hicks came along. Hicks and who was the other one who produced the ISLN further about the same time?
Hicks is the one who's...
But Hicks is the one who mostly got credit for.
Notably on it.
So far as Chicago was concerned, money was being taught by Lloyd Mintz, and that was still classical. He was there. When did you come? What year did you come?
Well, I was an undergraduate there, so I started in 63. But I had to leave.
Mintz had looked on me, by the way.
I had to leave because of the war, and so I left and came back.
You started in 63?
Yes.
And then you left because of the Vietnam War.
Right.
And then you came back when? But anyway,
yes,
Mintz had
70,
gone.
I think.
Yeah, Mintz had gone long before you came on the scene. He was still there when I first came on the scene. When I first came on the scene, Mintz was teaching money.
There's two things in terms of thinking about models. I mean, one is whether the price system works, and the other is how you think about the price level. And at that time, the profession was thinking of the price level as an institutional datum, controlled by large, the monopoly power of large corporations. And Mintz still had the idea that it was something that the central bank had to tie down. And that's forces you to think in a very different way. That combination of thinking that the price system works, and if you put the ideas together that the price system works, and the price level is part of the price system, that it's an equilibrating variable, but the changes in prices that count are relative, not absolute prices, then you put those two ideas together and you have the quantity theory. You're forced to think in those.
But relative prices count for allocation of resources, but the absolute price counts for the money market. That is for the, which is where the quantity theory comes in. The quantity theory is a pure price theory construct, absolutely.
But it is a variable that it is an equilibrating variable.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of a closed economy, it equilibrates the.
Oh sure.
It
equilibrates the demand and supply for money.
Right, and in the case of fixed exchange rates, it equilibrates the relative price levels between countries to give you the real terms of trade. But so I think that in terms of thinking about why you were willing to use the quantity theory, it had to be in part because you came through this binary tradition of thinking that the price system works, and you were willing to think about the price level as an equilibrating variable when the rest of the profession thought that was crazy because it was just the price level was going to be set by large corporations and by government controls, and to think of it as a variable that could equilibrate.
That also was a classical tradition. It was a tradition that I was taught as a graduate student, Mintz taught in 1932, 1933, 1934.
But what was...
And it was a coherent framework, because what Viner taught, what Mintz taught, what Air Director would have taught, fit together and were consistent with one another. They all believed that the price theory worked. System worked, and they all believed that economics was an instrument of analysis and not a separate discipline, a game, not a problem of mathematics.
see, Paul Douglas was also an important part of that intellectual atmosphere of Chicago. Even though his main field was labor, he was labor, viewed as a labor economy. He was very much of a quantity theorist.
So when you went to France to serve as a consultant for the Marshall Plan, talk about how European countries could make their European payments union work and begin to trade unilaterally rather than bilaterally. I mean, you had the Keynes's tract on monetary reform as an analytical apparatus, and so did everybody else. But other people weren't willing to use it because they weren't willing to make this leap of faith that the price level could vary to equilibrate the balance of payments, and you were willing to say, yeah, that's the way the world works.
But I'm not
there was
sure.
A faith in the price system that other people didn't have at the time. It wasn't that the analysis was suddenly just invented. It was there, but there had to be some reason you were willing to use it and make predictions with it when.
But I'm not sure that I want to make any statements about what other people thought, because certainly, by that time, you're talking about 1950,
yeah.
And Keynesianism was riding high, there's no question about that. And the Keynesian view was entirely as you say, that the price level was more or less, in principle, it was related to the quantity of money and everything else. But in practice, it was largely an institutional datum, and that the money supply would adapt to it rather than the other way. Certainly, this was the way people like Caldor would have approached it and thought about it. So I don't think, but why they took that position, you know, the psychology of it, I'm not going to get into that or get involved with it. I have a hard enough time knowing what I thought and why, let alone what anybody else thought and why. And so that's your interpretation, not mine. But I don't doubt that the general economic atmosphere that was produced by Chicago had a great deal to do with it. See, other people who came out of that. Take the case of Herb Stein. You mentioned having gone to his letters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Herb was a product of the later 30s. He was there 4 or 5 years. I never knew him in Chicago. But he came out of it, he would also have been a quantity theorist. And I suspect if Herb had gone to Paris, he might very well have come to the same conclusions I did.
Let's jump up to December 1967 in your presidential address and the natural rate hypothesis, which you first applied to the interest rate. The interest rate, like the exchange rate, is a nominal variable with a real kernel, and that real kernel is a price that serves as an equilibrating mechanism. Now, with flexible exchange rates, you took Keynes's analysis in the tract and you gave it life. And you did the same thing with Irving Fisher's analysis much later. And the question is, well, why didn't somebody else? Is the formal framework was there. And it's got to be because you were willing to see the real rate of interest, the kernel of the nominal rate of interest, as a price that worked as an equilibrating variable. So it had to have a unique a value at a time when other people thought it was just a lever for pulling on and for controlling the economy because the price system didn't work. So
I'm not sure that's right at all. No, I don't think so. I used, in the talk itself, and much earlier, I used the interest rate. I looked at Vixell's concept of an aphorism as a terminological rather than an analytical device. In that paper, the real rate of interest doesn't enter into that whole discussion. It's the real rate of unemployment that enters in. What enters in is the notion of what's really more important is the notion of expectations. And that what you're talking about is a difference between market prices and expectations. And that expectations are slow to adjust. And that's why you get the lag. But unless I'm mistaken, we can check that very easily, but unless I'm mistaken, the real rate of interest is not mentioned in that paper. I agree with you that I would have regarded the real rate of interest as serving an equilibrating function. I'm just saying that that paper is not... I must have a copy of that somehow here. Where do I have a copy of that?
The real rate of interest has a unique equilibrium value because of the role it serves in the price system. And, you know, that's why the Fed can't set the nominal rate of interest arbitrarily. But at the time, in the ISLM framework, the real rate of interest just is kind of whatever, you know, the monetary and fiscal authorities are carved.
The price level is being held constant.
Yeah.
Right. And it's clear that I was not assuming the price level to be held constant. But the 1967 paper was about the equilibrium, if you want, about the equilibrium price level and the equilibrium wage rate, but not about... The same analysis can carry over to the real interest rate. I'm just saying that as a historical fact, I don't believe, unless I am mistaken, essentially that same thing is in the chapter in my price theory.
Right, yeah, sure.
Okay. Yes, wage determination and unemployment, that's what I call the chapter headings, which deals with that. I'm just curious for a moment, where do I discuss the real rate of interest in here?
Well, it's at the beginning of it. You know, I should have checked that before I...
There, too, in respect to the real exchange rate, you had the same phenomenon at that time. Again, it was taken for granted that countries could set nominal exchange rates. And that was part of the belief. If price level is given, then the nominal exchange rate is the real exchange rate. Then you can set the nominal exchange rate, you can set the real exchange rate. Okay.
So then this won't take much longer, just a few more things I want to ask you about. So you went from the case for flexible exchange rates is your first sort of obviously quantity theoretic analysis.
No.
We've argued about that before. It's what...
Because you know, I would argue that the paper I had the AER on stability
framework for modern stability.
It's also a quantity theory now.
Right. It runs more off the real balance effect.
That's right.
And there's no discussion of price level. There's no discussion of price level stability.
I've got that here too, but I won't put it out.
No. Okay.
And anyway, it doesn't matter.
Sure. No.
You know, I don't think I don't personally regard it as very important whether it was in 19X or 19Y.
Sure. After the case for flexible, after you do the analysis in the case for flexible exchange rates in 1950, then you do the study of inflation and three wars. Mm-hmm. And you see the money stock as the single variable that can provide an explanation for inflation over those three very different periods. And you see the...
And you've seen this?
No.
It's a beautiful little thing. It's again about the Civil War.
Yeah.
And the Confederacy cut the supply of money by a third. Only because of the Mississippi had been lost, they couldn't control it in the West. So you have a nice comparison between the two, Richmond and... The question is whether it's war news or quantity of money.
Right, yeah.
And your mention of the three wars, I had just thrown that away. I had seen a much earlier version of it and commented on it.
Mitchell versus Newcomb.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So out of that analysis, you made the hypothesis that money demand is stable, and that gave you the way of making empirical predictions that you could then challenge the ISLM framework. That is, ISLM had been used as an expositional device for policymakers, but it had never been used to generate testable implications. And so you were the one that sort of laid down the gauntlet and said, okay, let's take this model seriously, the ISLM, and what are its predictions and against quantity theory predictions. So you then had a way of, with the case for flexible exchange rates, the empirical predictions were of the sort that if a country tries to maintain an overvalued exchange rate, it's going to have to disinflate and vice versa. And of course, over the years, those predictions have done very well indeed. I think people just sort of, those are part of how economists think now, and without realizing that they have to sign on to the quantity theory if they're going to do that analysis. This gave a different set of implications. When you were thinking about predicting income from autonomous expenditures, you realized that autonomous expenditures were part of income, so it became natural to think in terms of predicting consumption. When you began to think in terms of predicting consumption, that's what pushed you into thinking about the problems that led to a permanent income hypothesis.
No.
Through this?
No.
That was not that?
No.
Backdoor.
The permanent income hypothesis really arose out of the work I had done during the 30s in the National Resources Commission on the study of consumer purchases.
Right, but I had assumed that when you began to think about predicting consumption, then given that problem, then you went back and drew on the earlier work that you had done. That's what renewed this interest in predicting consumption. It was this Friedman-Meiselman way.
Friedman-Meiselman, but so far as the consumption book itself, the theory of the consumption, I don't think it developed out of that at all. It developed entirely, not only out of the earlier work, but much more out of the fact that we were in contact with people who were working on this problem. And this was a time when, because of Keynes, the consumption function had taken had become of great interest. And so you were having all sorts of theories, relative income hypothesis theory and so on. And it was contact with Margaret Reed and Dorothy Brady, and much more than the monetary. I think, in my own recollection, I would say that the monetary work and the theory of the consumption function were completely separate from one another. But the Meiselman paper, the paper I did with Meiselman, that certainly grew out of what you're saying. Let's see, have an empirical test and see what are the implications. And once you write it down, you see that if you're going to correlate income with investment, you're correlating part of income with itself. So you've got a spurious correlation. And then you do have to predict consumption. And then, no doubt, at that point, the connection with the permanent income hypothesis is staring you in the face. But I don't think that in actual research terms they had any relation to one another.
Okay, I thought the one sort of pushed you to go back to think about the other.
You're thinking about it retrospectively.
Sure.
You're making life much more logical and coherent than it really is. What interests me much more in this whole process is I really don't know where the interest in methodology came from. What got me started along that line? Because I'm sure that the piece on the methodology of positive economics had a great deal to do with my going after things like the free war comparison. And I was attempt to get, well, certainly that piece is intimately related to the theory of the consumption function. And that the whole structure of the theory of the consumption function is trying to carry out the idea of the methodology. Construct a hypothesis, see what its implications are, test those implications, and see if they are contradicted.
Right. The way I think of it is that this was a time when the economics profession was trying to decide whether it was going to become neoclassical economics or institutional economics. And to become neoclassical economics was to make it into a science. And there were two things going on at the time. One was taking the marginal insights of the earlier generation of people, of Valois and Marshall, and putting them into a coherent mathematical framework. And one group went off and did that, pure theory. And at the same time, in the 1930s, you had the development of statistical inference testing with Fisher, Sir Ronald Fisher in England. So in terms of making neoclassical economics into a science, the issue was how to fuse those two branches. And some people had a mind for pure theory, like Arrow and De Brewer, and some people had a mind for sort of pure measurement, like Kuznets and Abramovitz, but you had a mind that on the one hand, you liked the simplification that came through intellectual abstraction. In that sense, you were a pure intellectual. On the other hand, you had a pragmatic sort of American temperament of how does the world work.
So, Bernie Harold Hotelling.
Yes. So you were young at a critical time, and you had an unusual temperament to your mind. On the one hand, you liked the simplification that came through intellectual abstractions, but at the same time, your curiosity about the world wouldn't leave you alone. So you were able to put those two things together in a unique way.
I was very fortunate because I had the Chicago Theory and the National Bureau empiricism. I think National Bureau, my experience at the Bureau played it. But I really still don't know what got me started writing around methodology. Now, partly, in retrospect, I think you can construct various explanations. There was a dispute at that time about whether you should go around and ask people questions about whether they use marginal economic analysis in running businesses, maybe hitch stuff. And that generated a big discussion with Mock Loop involved and various other people on marginal analysis. But I still don't know, as I said.
Well, some of my hypotheses haven't worked out very well. One was that at the University of Wisconsin, there was a debate over whether the department should continue to look the way it had under Commons, or whether it should become a neoclassical department. But that didn't seem to be very. And one was that it was your debates with the Cowles Commission people over how to do the statistical inference that was associated with their view that you should describe the world as a set of stochastic difference equations. But your methodological views, I mean, you developed your views before you began the debate.
Yeah, I think that's right.
One hypothesis was that it was interaction with people like Karl Popper, but you developed your views before, so that's why I have this explanation I just gave you, which is that there are these two currents in economics that have to be married to create what we now accept as neoclassical economics, and it was the temperament of your mind.
Well, I think George Stigler and Alan Wallace played a role somehow. And George, you see, the interesting thing, if you go back to George's textbook, The Theory of Price, I think it's the only textbook you'll find which starts out by saying we want to explain a real phenomenon. Unless I'm mistaken, at the very beginning, I have the later edition, but this is, I think, this is a revised edition, but it's not the third edition, not the really revised edition. Beginning. George was trying to think of it in terms of an engine of analysis and not in terms of an intellectual system, not in terms of a general equilibrium structure, but of a supply and demand engine of analysis. And I believe he used a concrete example of a market phenomenon. How do we explain this market phenomenon?
So it's how you keep Marshallian analysis and yet work out the mathematical foundations.
That's
how you keep the ability to prove and disprove hypotheses and yet
have a formal
coherent framework, and it's putting those two together, and it was what had to be done, but the sort of striking thing about it is how hard it is to do even today, and how few people really successfully combine those two.
See, the Marshallian demand curve, my paper on this Marshallian demand curve, which is very early in this, published 49, is really about the same problem.
Sure, how you give substance to the income and substitution effects in a way that it has some content.
And it's consistent with general equilibrium analysis.
Yeah.
How you make partial equilibrium analysis, which is what you've got to use for, if you're going to understand real phenomena. With general equilibrium analysis, which is you've got to be consistent with if you're going to have a coherent framework.
So, you're right, it had to be, to some extent, having Alan Wallace and George Stigler to talk your ideas over with, but it had to have something to do with the badgeries of the time and this working for so long as a statistician.
Yes, I think.
Because then, when you came back to doing theory, you were a person trained to do statistical inference.
That's right.
So, if you hadn't had the serendipity of having to go to Washington and do consumption studies, and then working with Kuznets on the national income and product accounts data, and doing the statistical inference testing in the wartime studies, you wouldn't have had that apparatus. And
no, I think so, I think that's absolutely right.
And I want to ask one more question, and then I will. I think I've overstayed my welcome. In terms of understanding what was unique about monetarism, I know you don't like that word, it didn't come until 68, but the way I think of it is the way you gave empirical content to the quantity theory, how you made the quantity theory into a framework that would yield testable implications. You started with certain quantity theoretic abstractions, the price levels of a monetary phenomenon, and the price level varies to equilibrate either the money market or the balance of payments. But that was standard, you know, Keynesian monetary tract analysis. But you gave the quantity theory content by combining it with empirical hypotheses that were tested over a variety of monetary regimes, countries, and times. Of course, the stability of the money demand function, but the temporal relationships between a change in money growth and a change in nominal income and a change in inflation. So that created a sort of a very, that created a combination of tested empirical hypotheses in theory that you could then use to make additional hypotheses. So it was this common in terms of the methodology we just described. It's not a pure theory. People on one side or the other would say it's sort of a mongrel theory, but it worked as an engine of analysis. Again and again, you were able to talk about monetary theory and make predictions in a way that you wouldn't have been able to do if you hadn't been able to straddle both sides of economics, the empirical and the theoretical.
But surely, it's not clear what a pure theory is. S equals GT squared, 1/2 GT squared. That's an equation. It's a pure theory. It has obvious predictions, some of which will be wrong if you try to apply it to a feather floating in the air, dropping a feather. Now, is there a pure theory there? Yes, S=1/2 gt². But then there are rules for applying it. It's definitions of which, how you're going to measure time, how you're going to measure distance. So it's a, if you take natural science, don't you have exactly the same combination? You have hypotheses, like the hypothesis that a body falling in a vacuum will accelerate at a constant rate. And then you convert it into a predictive formula, like S=1/2 gt². And then you try to measure g, and you try to define under what conditions you expect it to work. And it seems to me that the what's going on is simply trying to make economics into a science of the same kind as a natural science. And so when you say it's a mongrel, I'm not saying you say it's a mongrel. There's nothing wrong with being a mongrel.
Yeah.
A mongrel.
Yeah.
So, that's a way of developing new species. And again, that's strictly Marshallian. Marshall does the same thing when he discusses long run versus short run.
What variable adjusts first is
empirical absolutely
judgment.
Right.
One thing then that leads to sterility in economic analysis is the feeling that everything has to be developed from first principles.
Yeah, I think that's absolute nonsense. I agree. It converts it into a mathematical game, not a... How do you develop S=1/2 gt² from first principles?
It came from watching falling bodies of different masses.
That's right.
And it told you what you
formulate.
See, now you can see what you could abstract from.
You formulate from
the object.
The hypothesis that body falls accelerates at a constant rate. And then you can mathematize that. I spoke a little too strongly about it after the nonsense. It isn't. That is to say, the notion that there are individual choices and decisions that underlie these magnitudes is a useful notion in suggesting what variables will be important. But the notion that you should not express a hypothesis about aggregates unless that hypothesis can be rigorously derived
from
first principles. That, I think, is not a useful idea. That says you've got to have a full Walrasian general equilibrium model for every proposition about any part of the economy.
And that's what makes it so hard to do economics now, because if you want to do economics, you have to develop this abstract model, and then you go look to see if it fits the data.
No.
And it's
no.
And the model's complicated, and it's going to fit along some dimensions, and other dimensions it won't fit along.
Well,
so you're never able to go back and reject the original model.
Well, you get the model from the data as well. It seems to me it's a two-way process.
Right.
It's not a one-way process.
But
it is.
It is the way that so many people do economics now. They feel like they have to write the complete model out first. Mm-hmm. It has to be correct. And then when they've done that, then they go look to see if it fits the real world.
Yeah.
And it'll fit along some dimensions. And other dimensions, it won't fit along. And they have no way of then going back and rejecting the model. So they make it more complicated. They add more epicycles to it to try to get it to fit better.
That's right. And that, again, is a correct analogy with the physical sciences. The heliocentric theory did not fit the data any better than the epicyclic theory, but it was a simpler, it was an Occam's razor thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Given the precision of astronomical measurements at the time, you couldn't differentiate between the Copernican
that's
and
my
Ptolemaic
that's my understanding.
Theories. They were observationally equivalent. It's just
that's
that
my
one was a lot simpler.
That's my understanding of it.
Yeah.
Okay, you got any more bad questions?
Oh, I do, but I'm not gonna bother you. And I'll